Good morning. This is Chair Peter Fisher. Pursuant to House Rule 10.01, I call this remote meeting of the Behavioral Health Policy Division to order. The clerk will take the roll of attendance.
Good morning. Frederick. Frederick.
Present.
Frankie.
Present.
Backer.
Backer present.
Baker. Baker. Becker Finn, excused. Hansen. Hansen. Katiza with Toon.
Present.
Lippert.
Lippert present.
Moeller.
Present.
Pearson.
Pearson present.
Thompson, excused. Let's see, Baker. And then I think a quorum is present.
Quorum is present. With quorum being present, we'll move on to the next part of the agenda, and that is the approval of the division minutes for January 27th, 2021. Are there any questions or corrections to the minutes at this point in time? Hearing
Mr.
none.
Chair, I move the approval of the minutes.
Okay. Was that Representative Lippert?
Yes.
Representative Lippert moves the approval of the minutes for January 27th, 2021. Please unmute for a voice vote. All in favor of approving the minutes, signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails and the minutes are approved. Our first bill that we will be hearing this morning is House File 287. The chair moves that House File 287 be recommended for referral to the Human Services Finance and Policy Committee. Representative Edelson, welcome to the division. We do have an author's amendment and this bill, and this is the first hearing of the bill, so the chair will move the DE author's amendment. Would you care to explain your author's amendment at this point?
Thank you, Chair Fisher and members. The DEE amendment significantly scales back the bill. After talking with stakeholders, we're really trying to work together on this. So it just puts it in the shape I want it to be in.
Okay, wonderful. I don't see any questions, so we will take a voice vote on the motion. All in favor of the amendment, signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? The DE-1 amendment is adopted. Representative Edelson, please go ahead and explain your bill as amended.
Thank you, Chair members, and it's good to see you all virtually. House Bill 287 is a pretty straightforward bill. It calls for the Department of Human Services with stakeholders to conduct a study and make recommendations for sober homes. As of today, sober homes are largely unregulated throughout the state. The Minnesota Association of Sober Homes, who is here today, known as MASH, independently certifies homes by privately hiring an inspector. The guidelines used from NAR, the National Alliance of Recovery Residences. But not every sober home that operates in Minnesota is a member of MASH, and there is no requirement for them to be. MASH has severed relationships with some sober homes because they did not meet the requirements that MASH has set out. But these businesses are still allowed to operate in our state with no protections for consumers. I come from a family of a lot of addiction, and this topic is very important to me. I support sober homes. They're such an important part of the recovery process. I also know just how vulnerable a person is when they are going through recovery. As lawmakers, it is our job to ensure that we have set protections for the most vulnerable in our state. Across the nation, legislatures are putting in consumer protections around sober homes. Connecticut, Georgia, Illinois have all adopted varying laws to set standards in their states. These states have put in consumer protections without raising costs. Minnesota is known in the recovery world as being the mecca, the place to come if you want to get sober and stay sober. It is so critical that we acknowledge the importance of having oversight and protections here. I would like to move now to the testifiers. There are so many, and would be happy to answer any questions at the end of the testimony.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Edelson. The first testifier we have today is Sue Afterholden. If you could please introduce yourself and who you're with.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, Sue Afterholden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota. And let me state at the outset that we believe sober homes have an important role to play in the substance use disorder system. We are not trying to close them or severely regulate them. We are trying to ensure some basic consumer protections. People who live in sober homes are not renters, so they don't have those rights. They are not patients, so they don't have those rights. So where do you go if you have valid complaints? Many NAMI bills are in response to people's stories. We receive over 4,000 helpline calls a year. Plus, we ask people about the barriers they face obtaining treatment or any problems within the system on nearly every evaluation we conduct of our classes delivered to thousands of people every year. We learn a lot about what works and what doesn't work. We've been asked why NAMI ventured outside the mental health system into the substance use disorder system. Well, about 50% of people with a mental illness also have a substance use disorder, which is why people have called NAMI about concerns with sober homes and why we are concerned about this issue. The complaints we have heard include homes being dirty, having mice, use of drugs in the home, people being evicted late at night with nowhere to go, and more. The letter from the ombudsman also confirms that there are problems. People lose their deposit if they leave early, including due to the bad conditions, and those deposits can range from $0 to $500. This is an issue not just in Minnesota, but around the country. In 2016, Senators Warren, Hatch, and Rubio, so bipartisan, asked the GAO to review the oversight of sober homes. The 2018 support bill signed by President Trump mandated the Secretary of Health and Human Services to develop best practices around sober homes. A toolkit put out by the National Council on Behavioral Health and the National Alliance for Recovery Residents points out that there are inconsistencies in quality because there aren't standards or protections. This report recommends that states adopt a common definition, establish a certification process, incentivize providers to adhere to national standards, and expand investment and technical assistance for recovery housing. SAMHSA issued a report on best practices for sober homes and included recommendations for states to define sober homes and the services they offer, including four distinct levels of care, recognize that co-occurring disorders often accompany a substance use disorder, assess applicants' needs and appropriateness of the residents to meet those needs, promote evidence-based practices, including medication-assisted treatment, evaluate program effectiveness and resident success. Quoting from the report, program or recovery house certification or accreditation is one noted remedy to some of the problems. States are advised to adopt a process of certification to assure program quality. You will hear later this morning the standards that MASH says they promote and follow, which are very similar to the NAR standards, so clearly they're not opposed to standards. And we would like to see homes that don't belong to MASH to follow standards. The real issue before you is transparency, accountability, and consumer protections. I want to be clear that we are not saying that all sober homes are bad. We are saying that some people have had problems with some of them. I'm glad that MASH was able to collect letters from people saying how helpful a sober home was to the recovery. But since MASH members self-regulate, I'd also like to know how many complaints they receive a year and what is their resolution. Is there information about the complaint posted next to their members' listing so that people know? I have had complaints from people who were in a MASH home as recently as last week, and they had no idea where to call for a complaint. There were no numbers posted in the home or in the materials that were given to them. Again, remember that not all sober homes are members of MASH. If they kick someone out of their organization, that home can still operate, and no one will know that it's a bad home. And frankly, we have no idea how many sober homes there are in Minnesota. Good stories don't negate the fact that there are people who have had bad experiences. We don't believe it's an overreach to ask that stakeholders come together to discuss the issues and develop recommendations on what oversight should look like, on what transparency should look like in this industry. What we all want are safe, sober living homes so individuals can advance in their recovery. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you, Ms. Abderholden. I see Representative Franke has his hand up. Representative Franke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a question for Ms. Abderholden. Ms. Abderholden, in your testimony, you said you've received complaints as soon as last week. How many complaints have you received, let's say, over the last year? Because in our material that was provided to us, we just have a couple of negative letters to almost 70 positive letters. So I'm not doubting there's bad actors in every industry, especially when it comes to one like this. I'm just wondering what the scope of what NAMI's receiving, because honestly, that might be just a fraction of what's, you know, with the people that also don't know where to go. Like you stated, there's no, you know, so could you give us an idea on the scope of what you're seeing at NAMI?
Ms. Abderholden.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Franke. So because we're not a licensing or regulatory agency, and frankly, with 4,000 calls with no foundation funding that, it's out of our general op. I mean, we don't keep like a tracking system, but I get, you know, calls into my office. And when we come to the legislature, we don't, you know, tell you like we've gotten 30 complaints or concerns. We bring concerns that we have to you. And again, I think this isn't about like how many people had good experiences and how many are bad. I think that this is an issue nationwide that people are looking into. And again, even MASH recommends that people adhere to some standards.
Thank you, Ms. Abderholden. Representative Franke, any other follow-up questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just like to say, yeah, no, we're not, and I'm not disputing that or that there's not a concern here at all. And I've had discussions with MASH and they agree, you know. So I was just wondering if you had an idea or could give us some type of a number. So thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome. Thank you, Representative Franke. With that, I see Representative Edelson has her hand up. Representative Edelson, go ahead.
Thank you. And then Representative Franke, I just also wanted to address, I think that's a great question. There's actually not a formal way outside of MASH's website, which is not easy necessarily to navigate, to put in complaints. So I just also wanted to note that we don't have a very standardized system for that. So I think that also is a problem that I think that we need to talk about.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Edelson. With that, we will move on to our next testifier, Stephen Nashan. I hope I'm going to pronounce your last name properly there. If you'd like to go ahead, identify yourself, who you're with, and start your testimony, please.
Good morning. My name is Stephen Nashan. It is a hard name to pronounce correctly. I was contacted by NAMI Minnesota to present my personal story as a consumer of a sober house. So I will never forget sitting outside my condo building in Chicago with my parents when the suggestion first came up that I consider an inpatient rehabilitation center. The idea terrified me. Together with my therapist, family, and doctor, I made the decision to come to treatment in Minnesota as it was explained to me that the treatment facilities in Chicago were not safe for a member of the LGBTQ community. Talk about terrified. At the time, I was 31 years old, and I owned a ballroom and Latin dance studio in Chicago when I first came to Minnesota in the summer of 2015. I'll never forget the plane ride here, anticipating being in a brand new state where I knew no one. My family was now 100 miles away, and all of the money I had saved up from my business had gone toward funding my inpatient treatment experience. Fast forward to now having graduated inpatient treatment, where the rest of my immediate recovery was solely in the hands of the sober house community in Minnesota. This is very different compared to other forms of medical illnesses that require follow-up treatment and check-ins. I have to begin talking about my sober house experience by saying that I benefited in many ways from my time spent in the Minnesota drug and alcohol treatment programs and sober homes. From 2015 to the end of 2018, I was either in a sober home, in inpatient treatment, or I was homeless and totally lost in my addiction. That was the merry-go-round I ended up being trapped on. I lived in 8 different sober homes. Some were specific to the LGBTQ community and others were just directed toward men in recovery in general. Here was my experience with the procedures around sober homes and how it affected my recovery. First was the entrance process. The first sober home I moved into, I had just come right out of inpatient treatment, so that experience was a bit different than the other 7. The other seven, I was coming right off the street and straight out of an active addiction situation. Sober homes that I went to required a 30-day sobriety time in order to be admitted into the house, which is sometimes hard to string together for those that are not coming directly out of an inpatient treatment setting. But it is also very easy to lie about if you're in a desperate enough situation. I'll never forget every sober house interview I had. They were always the same. I would go to the house where all the members and managers would sit in a circle and ask me questions, some about recovery, others not. They were up to the discretion of the members of the house. They would then send me away, and the members of the house would vote on whether or not to accept me. I would then be contacted days later. There were times where the answer was yes and other times where the answers were no. The process was a bit like a reality show and was not the most positive way for it to be handled when you're feeling vulnerable. The fear of not knowing whether or not you will have a place to live coming out of a treatment situation makes anything else in terms of recovery a little bit harder. It's hard to focus on attending meetings and staying sober when you don't have stable housing or know where your next meal is coming from. Once accepted into a sober home, I was then required to sign a contract and put down a sober house deposit, which for me ranged anywhere from $500 to $750, but never less than $500. This leads me to the experience inside the sober homes, which is by far the most positive part of my sober house experience. The rules of the houses were fair, and we as participants were required and expected to attend recovery meetings, look for jobs, do chores around the house, etc. These things were incredibly positive, and a lot of times the sober house allowed me enough time to put some of the puzzle pieces of my life back together. The rooms were fair. However, there were times I ended up in rooms with four or five other people in a twin bed, and at 6'4", you can imagine that was a little bit tough. But honestly, that never really bothered me. I was just grateful to have a home and safety and support. This leads me to my final piece of my sober house experience and probably the most damaging, which was the exit procedures. Before getting into this piece, I want to make clear that I have been living somewhere safe and drug-free for the last 3 years. Thank you to the kindness of a woman I met in inpatient treatment who took me in, and I've been helping her raise her children for the last 3 years, and that stopped the merry-go-round that I explained earlier long enough for me to get off. The rules in every sober house I lived in stated that if someone was suspected of using, returned to the house under the influence, or didn't return at all, they would be immediately evicted. It left a lot of room for interpretation, and in so many words stated that the sober house manager or owner could evict you at any time, really, for any reason. I understood this rule and signed the contract because I needed somewhere safe to be. And yet I ended up in situations 5 or 6 times where I would have a relapse and I was contacted by house managers who explained I was not allowed to return to the house. I would then go from being totally supported and accepted within the house to being totally outcast. They would immediately evict me, meaning I was not allowed to return home even for my things. They would pack up my things, and at times a lot of things would go missing. They would hold my sober deposit, and the worst part was no members of the house would speak to you anymore. Needless to say, I was not equipped to handle this, to be homeless in the middle of winter with no money, with no options really but to find a homeless shelter, return to inpatient treatment, or wait 30 days and try to locate $600 or $700 more to try my luck at sober living again. I tried all of these options, but there were also times I just had to become a person I didn't recognize just to survive. I fell into a level of addiction that didn't exist before I came to Minnesota and made decisions in order to survive that to this day I can't even fathom myself. Needless to say, the exit procedures in sober homes need to be looked at because I ended up losing thousands of dollars in deposits as a result of having no exit or relapse plan or strategies and found myself in positions I never should have. The experiences while inside the homes and while I was sober really did help me in many aspects, but the entrance and exit strategies of sober living need to be looked at, as well as the financial details surrounding deposits. Thank you for allowing me to share my story.
Welcome, Mr. Nashan. Thank you for coming and sharing your story with us. I noticed that Representative Backer has his hand up. Representative Backer, go ahead.
This question is probably more for Representative Ellison. A couple questions just to kind of, after hearing the testifiers, Representative Frankie said, we have not seen a lot of negative letters and our information, and this is somewhat new to me, so if I'm not 100% aware of everything, forgive me, but how did this stem, Representative Ellison, did NAMI come in front of you, or did you have one of your constituents who had a challenge with a sober home? How did this come up for us to look at a study like this?
Representative Ellison, go ahead, please.
Thank you, Chair. Representative Backer, the Star Tribune actually did a story on this a little over a year ago about the lack of regulations or any oversight on sober homes. It was brought to my attention then, and then last year, in talking with Ms. Abderholden, she had received some complaints then and had some concerns. And so that is how this bill really came to be. And so as we looked at it, we did notice that statewide, this is an issue that other states are also experiencing.
A follow-up question, please.
Sure, go ahead, Representative Backer.
Thank you, Chair Fisher. And this may be answered by someone else better. So is your intention or NAMI's intention to look at more of a licensing program? And then is there other states that does a licensing program or review process that we're talking about here?
Representative Edelson, would you like to try that or call on a testifier who might assist you?
Representative Backer, Representative, we're at this point, we want to do a study to look at, and we want to include MASH, and we've really made that very clear. I don't want to do the heavy, you know, fist of government. I really want to provide for our most vulnerable populations, protections. And what that looks like doesn't necessarily need to be licensure. It could be certification, what MASH does, but taking that and actually putting it on a state level so that we can have an official place where people can file a complaint. So think about in the instance of like our nursing homes or homes with disabilities, people with disabilities, we would never leave them 100% unregulated. We just wouldn't. I know last year just licensed assisted living facilities, but in doing so, we engage stakeholders on that. I would equate this very much to the same thing of trying to see what is the best answer. Right now, we don't have it, which is why we're asking for a study. What is the best option for Minnesota for a recovery, for our sober homes, and also for the people that are going through recovery?
Thank you, Representative Edelson. Representative Backer, any other further questions?
We're good for now. Thank you, Chair.
Okay, thank you, sir. And then I'll go to Representative Franke. Representative Franke, go ahead with your question, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This isn't a question. It's just a statement for Mr. Nassan, if he's still on the call.
I cannot tell right offhand if he is or isn't still on. I see our committee administrator saying he's not. He could be listening from.
Sure, if he's listening, I just wanted to congratulate him on 3+ years of sobriety. It's a long, hard road, and we want to thank him for his strength to come forward and tell his story. Things like this, I know, are hard. The road to where we get to is not always an easy one, so I wanted to congratulate him. That's it, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you, Representative Franke. Appreciate that. And as we're going forward here, if you have any more questions for the bill author, why don't we wait for those until after we get through the rest of the testifiers here. And for our next testifier, we have Dr. Sherry Welling. If you'd like to go ahead and introduce yourself and who you're with, please, and start your testimony.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Dr. Sherry Welling. I'm here on behalf of NAMI. I'm a licensed clinical psychologist in both Minnesota and California. However, I'm not here as a psychologist today. I'm here as a family member. My family and I relocated from Minnesota to California about 4 years ago. And in February of 2017, I received a call from a hospital letting me know that my brother David was in the ICU after an alcohol overdose. So I got on an airplane and I sat by his side for 10 days as he fought to come back to life. When he was ready to leave the hospital, he had nowhere to go. So I brought him back with me to Minnesota. As Representative Edelson said, professionally, I'm aware that Minnesota leads the country in access to high quality care for those who are seeking sobriety. And my brother Dave did really well in treatment. This was his first attempt after years of alcohol abuse. He did the work, he graduated, and he went to live in a sober living house. He got a job delivering Jimmy John's sandwiches by bike and another job running the omelet station at Hotel Minneapolis. So he was really doing quite well. The house was tough for him, though. The stove was broken. The washing machine was broken. So he spent his weekends at my house doing laundry and helping out, playing Frisbee with my kids. And he just didn't want to spend time at the sober house. He felt like, this again is his opinion, but he felt like he was the only one serious about treatment. He was worried about theft within the home, so he kept his cash and his guitar at my house. He talked about people using while they were living in the house. And he talked about how it was really tricky to tell anyone about this or get help about this, sort of that sense that you can't rat on the people that you live with. So his philosophy was to keep his head down, earn enough money to get a better apartment. Unfortunately, after a year of sobriety, Dave relapsed. He relapsed the day after our father died of esophageal cancer. So it was a time of tremendous crisis for him and for our family. And he went down a really dark tunnel for a few months, and then he was able to return again to treatment. And again, he did well. He was in inpatient treatment there in Minnesota. He wanted to keep the promise that he made to my dad. So he really benefited from treatment and from the safe place that he had to grieve and to heal. But eventually he was discharged from treatment and he went to another sober house. And this house was pretty terrible right away. He felt, again, very unsafe. He was taunted and mocked. I'm not sure really all that was happening for him, but he was, the best that I can explain, was terrified a few days after being in the home. He called and asked if he could stay with me. I have three young children and I just didn't feel like I could handle housing him as well. So I said no. He called my mom, who was recently bereaved. He called the treatment facility that he just graduated from. My mom called the treatment facility to ask for another placement. There was no response. So at this time of escalating crisis, there wasn't a clear path of help. We didn't know who to complain to. We didn't know who to call. So he was pretty desperate. He took all the cash that he had and he bought a train ticket to return to Montana, where he had been living previously. He made some calls, got a job, thought that he would have a new start, but it was too much too fast. And outside of a prescription, there was no continuity of care for him, and there was no safe place for him to catch his breath and to heal. My brother died by suicide on May 10th, 2018. He was 34 years old. And he died 3 weeks after graduating from treatment. So as a family member and a professional, I know this is not how this should go. We've long known that people are most vulnerable during transitions. They're most vulnerable to relapse. They're most vulnerable to suicide. And my family's experience with the sober homes is that they were not safe and they were not held accountable. They were not safe places to continue the recovery process. My brother was scared and he didn't know how to get help. And he wasn't granted the dignity of a safe place to sleep. So I'm hopeful that you will hear that in some cases, our most vulnerable people are clinging to whatever shreds of hope that they have. And they're going into places where there's not always regulation, where sometimes bullies rule and the basic dignities of physical and emotional safety are denied. No one could thrive in the situation that he was in. So one of my biggest regrets of my life is that I didn't offer him safety in my home. I didn't quite understand how terrible it was for him and how desperate he was. And I trusted the system of care. And I'm here to tell you that I shouldn't have. And it was felt like no one had his back. So thank you for listening to my story and listening to the story of my brother.
Thank you, Dr. Walling. First of all, condolences, and we're sorry to hear about the loss of your brother and what he went through during this time, and as a family, what you folks have suffered in the process. And thank you for your courage and your willingness to be able to come out and share something that is, I can tell, is very painful. So thank you, and this will help guide us as we go through the process today. We will move on to our next testifier then, Roy O'Brien. If you'd like to identify yourself and who you're with, please. and start your testimony.
Yes, I'm Rory O'Brien. I'm the chapter leader of Minneapolis Students for Sensible Drug Policy. Mr. Chair, thank you for the opportunity to speak today. My name is Rory O'Brien. I'm the chapter leader of Minneapolis Students for Sensible Drug Policy. We're the local ambassador chapter of the largest global youth-led network dedicated to addressing the war on drugs through sensible policy change. I also studied addiction counseling at Minneapolis College and I'm a harm reduction street outreach worker. Over the past 2 years, we have been interviewing and meeting with former sober housing residents and sober housing managers. Some of them have submitted written testimony for this hearing. While people did have positive experience at their sober homes, they also still had concerns about how homes were run and expressed concern over how other residents were treated. Out of the people who wanted to discuss policy change, there were more negative experiences than positive ones. The stories range from the common stories of being evicted after returning to use or relapse, to seeing people being evicted for not doing their daily chores, to residents being evicted and having the sober home call their place of employment, to stories where, in just a matter of weeks, multiple evicted residents had overdosed. One common theme we have been hearing from people opposed to a regulated system is that sober housing is a choice. According to data from the state's Drug and Alcohol Abuse Normative Evaluation System, otherwise known as DAMES, in 2017, over 17,000, or nearly one-third of the referrals to Minnesota treatment programs came from the criminal justice system. In our interviews, people who were experiencing homelessness said they were mandated to attend treatment, but that sober homes were their only option for housing. When evicted, they were left to the streets with no place to go and no resources to assist them. For residents, many were unaware of MASH or how to file a complaint. Another concern former residents brought to us is that most sober housing does not accept anyone on methadone or buprenorphine. From data listed by a popular outpatient treatment program, only 40% of their program's sober housing partners and only 35% of their MASH member partners allow methadone. A fourth of their partners still do not even allow buprenorphine, also known as Suboxone. In 2017, 20% of all Minnesota treatment referrals involved opioid use disorder. Methadone and buprenorphine are the only approved treatments in the U.S. shown to reduce risk of fatal overdose. With not only the media reports of overdose deaths at sober homes, but from the stories we have heard from past residents and being in an overdose crisis, these numbers are incredibly concerning. Additionally, the rights of people on medications for opioid use disorder are protected by federal non-discrimination laws, including the Fair Housing Act. Residents said that they had to make a decision to either be forced off their medications or to struggle to find openings at homes that accept them while balancing treatment and legal systems. Our organization supports Housing First policy. We do not want to lessen access to people who require sober housing, but expand it. In our discussions from our experience as service providers, as addiction counseling interns, from our members in recovery, and as former sober housing residents, we urged the legislature to consider an opportunity to develop an approach for regulations that protect and preserve the human rights of sober housing residents. We support this bill to study oversight of sober housing programs and believe it is needed to protect our most vulnerable populations of people with substance use disorders. Thank you. Oops. Mr. Chair,
Thank you for your testimony. Our next person to testify is Cynthia Scott. If you'd like to introduce yourself and start your testimony, please.
Good morning, all. My name is Cynthia Scott, and I'm the mother of a person who's in recovery and a resident of sober living. I offer testimony today in response to HF number 287. I take no issue with the study itself. What concerns me are the potential unintended consequences of such a study that could undermine the life-saving support provided by sober homes for our loved ones in recovery. Some concerning provisions in the bill point to potential governmental regulations so burdensome and cost prohibitive that affordable sober homes will be priced out of the market, leaving quality supportive housing available only to the moneyed class. My son is now fortunate enough to live in a high accountability sober home that's regulated by MASH. MASH sober homes do not warehouse their residents or allow them to lie around and rot and die just as long as they stay sober and pay the rent every month. These homes defy sober home stereotypes and have standards and regulations that make them conducive to recovery. While oversight has promised to remedy the abuses in this booming and unregulated industry, some provisions in this bill concern me when I play out the script on them. In particular, if certain evidence-based practices to support residents in their recovery are mandated, then will the state subsidize those additional required supports rather than allow them to drive up costs for sober home residents? Also concerning is the implication that sober homes may be mandated to allow medication-assisted treatment, or MAT. This creates a double-edged sword. The jury is no longer out on MAT. It saves lives, and I'm in favor of MAT-friendly sober homes, but choice needs to remain. For our loved ones who heroically battle an opioid use disorder, some choose a MAT-friendly sober home while others avoid these homes because they feel they would be disruptive to their recovery. Recovery is not a one-size-fits-all journey, and the government should not force this issue. They should let the free market decide. Recovery is such a treacherous journey, fraught with perils and pitfalls. Helping our loved ones break the grip of substances is just the initial stage in a long road to recovery. Love is not enough in the face of this profound suffering. Families need help. Quality, affordable sober homes bend the harm curve for families who face impossible odds. To borrow the words of a presenter I heard recently who offered comfort to families walking in my same shoes, quote, "We don't believe in brokenness. We believe in forgetfulness, and we must remind them of who they are." She's right. We call them up and we call them out because we know they're still in there, but they're lost. Because we love them, because we stay brave, we fight to help them find their way back home. For now, Minnesota is my son's home, and he's thriving there. And I want him, as well as others in recovery, to continue to have the opportunity to live in health, safety, and dignity. I hope Minnesota finds its way to lead the nation on this issue. As a global mecca for recovery, it already shines a bright light in calling so many of the lost back home. A well-managed sober home is a critical component to the continuum of care. The challenge for Minnesota will be to balance the need for oversight and regulation with the need to need for access to affordable, quality, sober housing. Instead of overreaching, please investigate and implement the best practices of organizations like MASH and other leaders in the field who are already ahead of the curve in committing to self-regulation and improvement in the quality of their sober homes. I'm grateful for your time and consideration of my heartfelt views.
Thank you for your testimony. Next we have on the list, Brandon Huggins. If you'd like to introduce yourself and start your testimony, please.
Yes, hello, my name is Brandon Huggins. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I've been asked to give my experience living in sober housing. I currently have over 2 years sober, and I owe a great portion of that to sober living. I must start with a preface of my experience before moving into sober living. I started using drugs and alcohol at the age of 14. By the age of 14, I started using methamphetamine. Over the course of 20 years, I have used and abused every drug and alcohol under the sun. In 2014, I lost my job. I was cut off from my family and became homeless due to my addiction. Over the next 3 years, my addiction progressed, and fighting to survive on the streets of Minneapolis, it became increasingly difficult. I began to have many run-ins with law enforcement and rapidly racked up legal issues. I was court-ordered to complete 30-day inpatient treatment. With nowhere to go once I had completed inpatient treatment, I went back to living on the streets and continuing the revolving door of jails, treatments, and homelessness. Rinse and repeat. My addiction progressed along with my legal problems. Third time I was court ordered to go into treatment, I was required to follow aftercare recommendations, of which moving into sober living was one of them. I had expectations that sober living was going to be difficult since I had been homeless for years. I knew that I was going to have to change the way that I was living my life, and I was unsure I was going to be able to follow through with it. I asked my counselor in treatment what house he would recommend. He recommended one in St. Paul that did not allow Suboxone or methadone, being as I had used and abused those chemicals as well. I wanted to find a house that was an abstinence-based house and that proved a little more difficult, being in the current climate of the opioid epidemic. Another piece of the puzzle that I knew I was missing was a connection to other people. I found a house that strongly recommended connecting with other men in the house as part of the program and being able to stay in the program of the sober house. The sober house that I moved into felt more like a family rather than an institution. I firmly believe that the relationships that I made with the men in the house helped me stick around for long enough to live a different way. After a few months of living in a house, I got a job close to my house and began to value myself again, an opportunity to choose not to become what I had learned I was worth. I no longer felt like an outcast. I felt like I was part of a family, a community full of support and love. I felt safe for the first time in years. The sober house encouraged me to become part of society and volunteer. I was discharged from probation early. I was promoted in my job. I now have a healthy relationship with my family and reconnected with my heart, and I no longer feel worthless. My experience with sober living has saved my life. I have purpose, and I am uniquely gifted to help others that are lost. I believe with all my heart that sober living was key to my success. In my experience, I have seen management remove other members of the house that are under the influence. Though this has happened, I witnessed the management give opportunities for a safe place to go from the sober house. They're given a choice to go to detox or get in contact with their past treatment center. If these people refuse to do either one of those, I've witnessed and personally have taken people to a hotel so they don't have to go back to the streets. Over the past few years, I have seen firsthand how MASH has upheld the standards for what sober living should look like. I've met people in the sober community that have gone through the MASH managers training, as so have I. And they are clear of what their objective is. MASH requires a house to be safe and the living environment for addicts and alcoholics to become self-sufficient and productive members of society. MASH does a great job with regulating the consistency through their houses that belong to the association and continue constantly to look for ways to improve it. Thank you for your time, and I will pass.
Thank you, Mr. Huggins, for taking the time to come share your story and your experiences with us today. Very much appreciated. The committee appreciates it. First of all, I want to let the committee know that we do have another bill that's going to be coming up that I'd like to try to get underway by about 9:30 or so. We do have two more testifiers, and I also do know that I'm starting to see some hands up, so I'm hoping that we can try to wrap this up within about the next 20 minutes or so. With that, we'll be moving on to our next testifier, and I understand there'll be a little presentation with this here. Mr. John Curtis, if you'd like to introduce yourself, who you're with, and start your presentation, please. You're on mute, sir.
Thank you, Chair Fisher and committee members. My name is John Curtis. I'm the president of the retreat in Wayzata, Minnesota, in St. Paul. I'm also the co-chair of MASH and one of the co-founders of MASH. I'd like to really start by just giving a bit of a historical perspective of the sober house community. Sober living has been around Minnesota for since the 50s or 60s in Minnesota. So they're not new. And they started in a very organic way. They're sober people leaving a halfway house or leaving treatment and decide to live together as a family, to support each other, to be happy and sober and learn how to enjoy a life in recovery. So they're mutually managed, democratically operated, sober living communities. They're homes. They're not treatment. They don't provide services. They don't provide clinical care. They're supportive housing for people who are living a sober life. And like with any homes, there's dysfunction from time to time in people's homes. So MASH was developed in 2007 to help address some of that dysfunction and to begin to, you know, put together some uniform set of standards that all sober houses in the state could live by. So we focused our attention on basically three pillars: operational standards, life safety standards, and ethics. You can see the organizational structure of MASH. We have 8 board members, and all volunteer, of course. We have a full-time administrator, paid, and a part-time inspector, house inspector. And then we have a recovery core project coordinator. And we have a number of committees, and the committees deal with issues such as ethics and complaints, training for our members, advocacy, membership, marketing, public relations, and standards. We have many volunteers, hundreds of hours of volunteer time that have gone into the growth and development of MASH over the years. Right now we have 58 members representing 158 houses and about 1,600 beds. It is true that these are not all the sober houses in the state of Minnesota. But what we're finding over time is that the market itself is beginning to drive more people into MASH. Many treatment programs, Hazelden, The Retreat, Fairview, a lot of programs, refer only to MASH-certified houses. And I think over time, we'll begin to see more of that happening. So the next slide, if we can bump one more. The standards that we've adopted with MASH are the national standards put together by NAR, the National Alliance of Recovery Residences. And it's important to note that really many of these standards were developed by MASH and Minnesota Sober Homes and were given to NAR to help them put together the national set of standards. And the standards are, and we have given you handouts that are the entire set of standards, so I'm not going to go through all of those now. But there are 105 requirements that are set forth in these documents. And they've been approved by SAMHSA as a national best practice set of standards for sober living and recovery residences, which are basically the same thing. Different states call them different things in the U.S. And most of the, I would say that most of the states or most of the sober houses in the state of Minnesota fall under category 1 and 2 levels. So as you're looking at the standards and reviewing them, it's important to note that those are the levels that exist mostly in Minnesota. And certainly all MASH houses fall under those 2 levels. So, and the domains look at a variety of different issues related to administrative, financial transparency, data collection, mission statements, honest marketing materials so that you say what you are and are very clear to the public what you provide, and background checks on staff. And I'm just highlighting a few key issues under various domains.
Excuse me, Mr. Curtis, I'm sorry to interrupt, but I'm noticing that we're starting to get it tight on time. If you could speed up the presentation so that we can hear from the other testifier, and I'm noticing the list of questions from committee members starting to grow.
Okay, so, you know, basically, I also want to call attention to the fact that we do have a complaint process. In our website, there is, now I will apologize because our website is, we're just transitioning and it's new. But people have called MASH for years, talking about issues they may have related to sober housing. And then we do what we can to help address these complaints. Obviously, it's our hope that most, complaints can be resolved within the family, within the supportive community that they're living in, between the management and the residents. However, that's not always possible. And that's when MASH steps in and does our process in terms of reviewing and addressing complaints. We look for documentation. We want timeframes on complaints. We want written notification of the complaint process, and we want to be able to communicate to all parties involved how they were resolved. So the next slide, actually, if you move to the next slide, one more, please. You know, I'm gonna have Chris talk mostly about this. He's the next presenter, and Chris deals on a day-to-day basis with the complaints that come into MASH. And he's probably the most qualified to talk about the details of what we do in the process. But our, you know, we do trainings with all of our members. Twice a year, we bring in 125 different owners and operators and managers. We review ethics at every training. We have all the managers and operators sign off on the ethics agreement that they all are committed to following those standards. We bring in presenters on mental health co-occurring issues, harm reduction strategies, MAT strategies, co-occurring or cultural sensitivity issues. So many different topics. The fire marshals come in and present to MASH. The city of St. Paul requires that all sober houses prior to receiving their reasonable
accommodations
are members of MASH.
Sorry to interrupt again. We're very, very short on time. Can you get, I want to remind committee members that we do have this presentation sent to us and it is on the web. Mr. Curtis, do you have one or two closing remarks and then I can move on to Mr. Edderington?
I would just say that, again, thank you for letting us present. And I want you to know that there's a lot of work that's gone into helping to raise the bar in terms of quality of services available in the sober house world in the state of Minnesota.
Thank you, Mr. Curtis. Next, we have Chris Edderington. If you could please identify yourself and who you're with and start your testimony, please. And I'd like to try to keep this to about 3 or 4 minutes. I do have four people with questions out there. Thank you.
Okay. Hi, my name is Chris Edgerton. Thank you, Mr. Chair, representatives. Glad to be here today. As John said, I'm a board member of MASH. I'm also a founding board member of NAR, the National Association of Recovery Residents that John mentioned. Recovery Residences is kind of an umbrella term for all kinds of different sober houses around the country. When they asked me, the people that started NAR in Georgia in 2011 to come to Georgia to help start this organization, they said, would you please bring with you the MASH standards, because we know you guys already have a lot of stuff. That we John and I started MASH in 2008 or 2007. What I really like to focus on is giving people an understanding of how the day-to-day operation of a sober house actually functions and works. And it's very, very simple. The continuum of care, where we had some speakers talk about their primary treatment experience, and then after that, sometimes they go to an extended care, which is sort of treatment light, for lack of a better term, halfway houses, extended care. Those programs are largely disappearing from the continuum, and people are going straight from primary to sober living with some outpatient services. When you get to the sober living level of care, the facility type living arrangement and the clinical services are gone. This is now a social model of recovery. And like Brandon mentioned, connecting to the other people in the house is really the push. The medicine of recovery at the sober living level is in the community. So engaging with other sober community, other sober individuals, first in your house and then outside in the greater sober community and in the general community, is crucial in the process. So when we have something in the house that disrupts that, like someone returns to use or someone's behavior gets in the way, it's very, very difficult to keep that momentum, that sort of milieu going in the house, where if somebody decides they're no longer interested. And we try to pull them back in. We have lots of different ways of doing that. You guys can ask whatever questions you want. But I really want people to have an understanding that to live as a family and support each other, to take advantage of the giant sober community we have in the St. Paul area, is really what goes on day in, day out. It's not a facility. It's not treatment. It's not meant to be regulated in a sense of like it's a licensed facility where you have to meet all these requirements. It's really about life on life's terms every day, living your life as and trying to feel like I'm back in society and I feel like less of a worthlessness, like the other gentleman said. And our practices within MASH, our manager training, our ethics, our policies and procedures, all push towards that environment and creating an atmosphere in the house that is healthy, supportive, and functional. Early recovery is messy, as you can imagine. People are shedding a layer of skin and reinventing themselves, and it's difficult, and it can be dramatic, and sometimes it can get out of hand. I'm the one on the board, MASH, who does answer the complaints. We have a process that's been in place for several years. I probably do. Some months there are no complaints. Most months there are 2 to 3. Typically, as you saw on the slide, what I do is I hear from the complainant. I get the operator.
Excuse me, Mr. Edrington, I hate to interrupt you. We're starting to run close on time here, and I'd like to be able to get to some of the questions here that the representatives have.
I just wanted to wrap it up, please. How that process worked, but you can ask, anybody can ask a question if they want.
Okay. Thank you, sir. We will now go to the committee people for their questions. I will start off with Representative Baker. As we get started here, I'd like to get it's the chair's intent to have us take a vote by 22:10 so that we have time to get to the next bill. We do have a hard stop at 10 o'clock, so I just want to make sure that we keep moving along here. Representative Baker, go ahead, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe a couple quick questions. Representative Edelson, have you been to a number of sober homes or have toured them? Have you been in there yourself?
Representative Edelson, quick.
Thank you, Chair, Representative Baker. I have not. In fact, I wanted to, but COVID hit when we had this bill last year, and I did reach out to Chris Edrington at that point. And so it hasn't really been a possibility.
Thank you. And then back to Mr. Chair, because I want to be kind of quick about this.
Right. Go ahead, Representative Baker.
Your indulgence. And back to Chris from MASH, again, I have been to a number of homes because of my history. And again, the testifiers here today were amazing, and there's some amazing stories. One of the things about sober homes that I have had personal involvement with when my son was going through them and working with other treatment facilities that actually own some sober homes is the rent is very affordable. And it's anywhere from $75 a month to maybe $150. I know it can be higher depending on the location. I'm talking more in rural Minnesota. And that is a real key part. Recovery, this is more to the members, I guess, not so much to Chris. Recovery is not a smooth pathway. It is a bumpy process. And this is not a safe house. It's not a place where we can expect that Everything's going to be perfect. We have our places in our society that are that way. I think the bill is not a bad idea, Representative Edelson. I think it's something that we can get behind and get looking at. We can talk about this. If we start regulating it, though, folks, my concern is we are going to outperform, outprice, and this won't work anymore, and there's going to be more people that won't have a place to go, because if the state gets involved, we get wrapped up in liabilities with the state of Minnesota. I think we all know that. I'm going to pass on my question to Chris, because I know we're short of time, but I'm very engaged in this. I hope I can help out as well, Representative Edelson, but I do have really a lot of concerns about moving too quickly to jumping to regulation, and I'm happy to visit with that some more. So thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Baker. Next, we'll go to Representative Katisa Watoon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Edelson, for bringing this bill forward. I appreciate all the testimony here today, and I think it's so powerful to learn more about this additional step in people's recovery process. I think it's important to point out, just like Representative Baker just said, that some people are just predisposed to suspicion about regulation or consumer protection, and I think that oftentimes it is actually a benefit to protect people as they move through this process, and if they have underlying behavioral health conditions, et cetera, et cetera. I also want to circle back and make sure that people, the public especially, realizes that this bill is not establishing any regulation. It's you know, going to put together a stakeholder recommendation panel, and I think that certainly with MASH and NAMI and some of the others, I think that we'll be able to really put together a strong report on these recommendations to bring back to the legislature so we can examine and consider moving forward with whatever that may look like in the future. But I'm curious, Representative Edelson, as far as other states that do have oversight, what does that financially look like for sober homes in those locations?
Representative Edelson, if you'd like to go again, once again, I want to try to keep questions and answers quick here, please.
I'll keep it quick, Chair. Thank you. Representative Katisa Watoon. Other states, it varies, but annually, it is a study, so we're not recommending anything at this point, but other states have not seen huge cost increases, which makes their homes not affordable to people. Some states are $300 to $400 annually with $1 per bed. So this is absolutely a cost. These homes can absorb this cost without raising the costs. But again, we're not even talking about whether or not I hear licensure, and I'm not saying we should license. I just say that we want some oversight and protections.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Edelson. Any further questions or comments? Thank you, Representative Katisa Watoon. Next, I'll go to Representative Moeller. After Representative Moeller will be Representative Lippert, and then Representative Franke will get the last questions, and they'll be moving on from there. Representative Moeller, go ahead, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question is for Mr. Curtis. I'm curious about inspection of your homes. I looked at your NAR Principle E, and it looks to me like everything is really self-verification. And so I'm wondering if you hire inspectors, how the inspection process works, and then if there's a problem, how do you make sure that that problem's been resolved?
Thanks for the question. Yes.
Mr. Curtis, go ahead, please.
We do have a process where we inspect each house. When a member wants to join MASH, we do a thorough house inspection going through the entire checklist of the requirements, health safety, life safety, operational standards, all of them. Anytime there's an issue that's identified related to a facility or life safety issues, MASH will do a spot inspection unannounced on the house. And we also do biannual inspections of houses. So, and the inspectors are both board members and a person who's a facility inspector, so that they have experience looking at the details of facilities.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Curtis. We'll now move on to Representative Lippert. Representative Lippert, go ahead with your question or comments, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just simply have a comment. I just want to thank Representative Edelson for walking into the center of this conversation, for your care for people who are in the midst of treatment and recovery, and recognize this is not an easy road. It's not a linear process. I want to thank the testifiers for courageously sharing their stories with us. for the sake of helping others. It's extremely important. I think that from testimony today, it's clear that both Minnesota has a reputation for care for those who are in treatment, which is extremely important and powerful, and we can do this work better. And so I think a study, looking at it carefully, is a simple step we can take, a step that we owe to those who are in treatment and recovery and want to improve their lives. So I just want to thank you for the bill, Representative Edelson.
Thank you, Representative Lippert. Next, we have Representative Franke, and then as we're done with that, then we'll move on to the voting on the bill. Representative Franke, go ahead, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a few comments here. First off, I want to thank Representative Edelson for bringing this bill forward. Full disclosure, throughout my years of recovery, I have the experience of staying in sober homes. So I would hope that Representative Edelson, if you have any questions, you can reach out to me. I do have experience in this area. Unfortunately, I think for MASH, they're trying to do the best that they can. They are an organization that is out there, so they take the brunt of the bad actors. I am not opposing this bill. I am not opposing that. I've seen some of these situations in real lifetime. I've lived them. So I am worried about the unintended consequences. Severely, we do not have enough bed spaces out there for people in certain transition points in their sobriety and recovery. And as many of the testifiers have stated, they are critical. Those points in your recovery are critical points that can send you one way or the other, either up or downward in your reintroduction into society and becoming functioning and believing in yourself and your fellow community members. So once again, I'm going to support this bill. I'm hoping that when the study happens and it comes out that, you know, we all can get back together and discuss where this goes. I do not want to see overregulation. I want to see some type of a, you know, positive experience come out of this, not only for the people we're looking to, you know, protect from harm, but for the associations that are doing the right things and doing the best that they can, like MASH, and hopefully being able to expand this into something other than what we're kind of hoping that it's not. So that's it, Mr. Chair. Thank you. I'll end there.
You're welcome. Thank you, Representative Franke. Thank you for sharing with us and your thoughts. Representative Edelson, any very quick closing remarks here? 1 minute.
Yes, and I just, Representative Franke, just want to say I look forward to working with you. I have heard that you are passionate in this area and absolutely want to work with you. This bill truly is not meant to be a heavy hand of government. This bill is really meant to say we, as this mecca of recovery in Minnesota, really owe Minnesotans to look at this. People that come to our state to look at this issue and to work together. So I will continue to work with MASH and any other stakeholder or representative that is interested in this to be a collaboration. This should not be bipartisan, members.
Thank you, Representative Edelson. At this point in time, the chair renews his motion that House File 287, as amended, be recommended for referral to the Human Services Finance and Policy Committee. The clerk will take the roll.
Fisher.
Fisher votes aye.
Fisher, aye. Frederick.
Aye.
Frederick, aye. Franke.
Aye.
Franke, aye. Backer.
Backer, aye.
Backer, aye. Baker. Baker.
Aye.
Baker, aye. Hansen. Hansen.
Aye.
Hansen, aye. Katiza Watoon.
Aye.
Katiza Watoon, aye. Lippert.
Lippert, aye.
Lippert, aye. Moeller.
Moeller, aye.
Moeller, aye. Pearson.
Pearson, aye.
Pearson, aye. There being 10 ayes and 0 nays, the motion prevails.
Okay, with the 10 ayes and zero nays, the motion prevails. House File 287, as amended, is recommended for referral to the Human Services Finance Policy Committee. Thank you, Representative Edelson. Thank you, everyone who presented and everyone involved. I'd like to remind people, if anyone would like to submit testimony in writing, please do so to the committee within the next 24 hours. Next, we will be moving on to House File 375 from Representative Joaquin. The chair moves House File 375 be recommended for referral to the Human Services Finance and Policy Committee. We do have an author's amendment, and this is the bill's first hearing. So the chair will move the A1 author's amendment. Very quickly, Representative Joaquin, can you explain your amendment?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members. The A1 amendment just narrows the bill a bit to what scope of outpatient treatment is allowed.
Thank you, Chair Joaquin. All in favor of the A1 amendment signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? The A1 amendment is adopted. Representative Joaquin, welcome to the division. Please present your bill as amended. And I want to remind folks that we do have a hard stop at 10 o'clock and that I want to make sure that we have this voted and done by that point in time. Thank you, Representative Joaquin. Go ahead.
Good morning, members, and Mr. Chair, thank you for hearing this bill. We've all witnessed the growing stress that our young adults face today and have heard testimony in many of our committees about the need for mental health support in our schools and communities. While the stress our students face existed before COVID-19 and will exist long after, the global pandemic has shown a harsh light on the lack of support and a safety net for those students who are struggling. This bill is a small step that we can take to give our students the tools they need to access mental health supports before things become dire. In current law, a 16 and 17-year-old is allowed to check themselves into an inpatient facility of their own accord, but cannot access the help of mental health professionals in an outpatient setting without parental permission. I first learned of this odd discrepancy when I had coffee with Ms. Livstein, an engaged student that you will hear from momentarily. With this bill, it is our hope to allow young adults to get the help they need long before requiring a hospital stay. Delaying urgent care can be costly in so many ways. Sometimes these delays can be as simple as a language barrier or time constraints for the parents of the student, or it may be just a lack of knowledge of the resources available. Whatever the case may be, we want our young adults to get the needed help without the costly delay. Members, you should know you have three letters of support in front of you for this bill. They're from NAMI, the Minnesota School Psychologists Association, and the Minnesota Psychology Association. I also have a group of incredible students here today to share their stories with you. I will let them introduce themselves as they go along, but the first one is Liv Steen. She's a Hopkins High School senior who is a member of the Hopkins School Group called Mental Health Matters, and Ms. Steen also serves on the Minnesota Youth Council.
Thank you, Representative Joaquin. Ms. Livstein, if you'd like to go ahead, introduce yourself and start your testimony, please, and welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Livstein. I'm a senior at Hopkins High School, president of Mental Health Matters and representative for the Minnesota Youth Council. Mental Health Matters works to bring student voice and advocacy into school mental health services. A few years ago at Hopkins High School, we were assessing the barriers to mental health services at school. The two biggest barriers we discovered were transportation and parental consent. Parental consent is often due to family dynamics, cultural differences, and generational differences. I've had friends and fellow students tell me about the struggles of bringing up the topic of mental health in their homes. They told me their parents would tell them to suck it up or that mental illness isn't real. I've had friends who have spent years trying to convince their parents to let them go to therapy, and it is not because their parents didn't care about them, but because they were afraid of their child suffering. And letting them go to therapy is like admitting that their child is suffering. No parent wants a child in pain. A similar thing happened to me with a key difference. We spoke about mental health in our house, and still it took an unnecessary amount of time to convince my parents to let me go to therapy. I know that I was very lucky, especially acknowledging the generational differences of my parents and me. My mom, 65, and my dad, 71. The decision was even harder for them as they have many more mental blockages around mental health and mental illness due to their generation. I reached out to Representative Joaquin two summers ago to get the ball rolling around this bill. That is where this comes in. In the process, I reached out to students and former students around the state who have had similar experiences. Here is one excerpt from one of those former students. Mental health has never been discussed in the former student's household. And when I brought it up to it was shrugged off and seen as not a Black people thing. Later, I was ridiculed for isolating and missing school due to my depression. This went back and forth between my parents. They made me feel like something was wrong with me, the former student continues. How was I supposed to think anyone would listen? It definitely didn't make me want to stay here, meaning alive. They later go on to tell me about how it made them resistant to treatment later on, but once they grew out of that, they started outpatient treatment, and they said it was nice to have someone to acknowledge the significance of their pain. That is just one of many students slash former students whose parents were not horrible people. Their parents just grew up differently, and it made the road to recover harder. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Steen, for your testimony, and thank you for coming before us to testify today. Next, we have Ms. Linda Nayakundi. I hope I'm pronouncing that some very closely there. Please introduce yourself and start your testimony, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You were really close. I'm Linda Nayakundi with Mental Health Matters, and I'm also a senior at Hopkins High School. And I chose to volunteer in support of this bill to bring to your attention another point of view on this topic. I was born in Kenya into a culture where discussing topics like mental health was looked down upon. I believe I can speak for most when I say I am incredibly thankful for the mental health resources that my district has available. And as I continue to grow older and continue to learn more about mental health, I found it rather difficult to have these conversations with my parents, seeing as it is shut down and mental health is sort of an embarrassing thing to talk about. Knowing that I would be able to make the decision on my own if I was ever wanting to seek help would be a sigh of relief and give me more time to explain and ease this conversation in with my parents, seeing as I would want to have them involved, it would just take a little longer to get the confirmation from them as well. And I think it is important that when help is needed and if I were to ever seek immediate help that I would be able to get it. And having this bill be passed would be really helpful in being able to start that conversation with my parents and as well with some other students that might be in my position. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Nayakundi, for coming and speaking to us today. I appreciate that. Next, we'll move on to Ms. Joria Jama. If you'd like to start your presentation, please. Thank you for coming to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning. My name is Joaria Jama. I'm a junior at Spring Lake Park High School, and I represent Congressional District 5 on the Minnesota Youth Council. So I wanted to share my story with you all. I'm here this morning in support of House File 375. Around this time last year, I was going through one of the worst mental health crises of my life. I was a student that was usually really attentive and engaged in school, but when my depression hit rock bottom, I couldn't force myself to be interested in class. Even my teachers began noticing as my grades started to slip, and I wasn't sure where to turn to. My teachers began noticing and tried to help me as much as they could, extending my essays and helping me take my tests at home, but it wasn't enough. I had to rely on their support and care for me to get me through the year, but they couldn't do more than that. Teachers are extremely important in helping students, but they are not our therapists. While my teachers could extend assignments for me, they couldn't talk to me about my mental health or help me get better. The only other option I had was to turn to my school counselor. Our school only has one counselor that is stretched thin across our entire district. And at our high school, like many high schools across the state, they require parental consent before allowing us to get a mental health referral through our counselor. The requirement of parental consent for mental health treatment in high schools and clinics prevent a lot of young people like myself from being able to get help. Because many parents do not believe or understand why their kids need support, this stops us. A lot of this comes from the stigma surrounding mental health, but also the cultural and religious backgrounds that some families come from. In certain ethnic households like my own, mental health isn't something that is prioritized, and some elders believe that you can pray the depression away. In other households where young people might be getting abused, their parents can stop them from seeking help, and this continues the cycle of depression leading to suicide in young people. I believe that we are way past the time needed to give better mental health access to young people. And if a bill like this was in place last year, I may have been able to get the help I needed faster. I hope you all are able to listen to the concerns of young people like myself and that this bill is able to pass. Thank you for your time.
You're welcome. Thank you, Ms. Jama. And I want to say thank you once again to all three testifiers. You all have done an excellent job of presenting, and we appreciate you taking the time to share your stories with us. I do see a hand up with Representative Mueller. Representative Mueller, if you'd like to go ahead, please.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just wanted to thank Representative Joaquin and the testifiers for your really powerful and helpful testimony today. So thank you. And as you were talking, Ms. Jama, I was also thinking about other high school students who might be accessing counselor services within their school and needing parental consent who are 14 or 15 years old. And I recognize that this bill isn't necessarily going to those age groups, but I wouldn't mind in the future if we could talk about extending it to them as well. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Mueller. And I would also like to say to Representative Joaquin and to our testifiers, thank you. I've very strongly supportive of this. I appreciate Ms. Jama, the stories that you told. I worked for 14 years in the homeless youth world, and a number of our youth, one of the frustrations I had is that some of our youth that we were working with needed mental health services, but because they were under 18, the parents were still able to interfere and prevent that from occurring. So I want to thank our author for bringing it forward, and for you, Ms. Jama, for being able to state some of the things that some of the youth out there are dealing with. And with that, I see Representative Baker has his hand up. Representative Baker, go ahead, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Joaquin. This is a really good conversation to have. I do support this, but maybe a question I have to the author is, and I really do understand where some family dynamics make it really hard for the conversation to happen with mom and dad about mental health, and they don't understand depression, they don't understand addiction, they don't understand those things because of their culture, because of their upbringing, and so on. At some point, Representative, does the parent get involved, or is it made aware of? And can you just walk me through that so the parents know how they can be part of the support system then? So is this kept a secret, or just, I kind of want to get that, so thank you.
Representative Joaquin, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Baker, for the question. I'm really glad you asked it. I'd point to the letter from NAMI, and the reason why we have the support we do is because part of treatment and part of the whole wraparound services of when you do work with kiddos with mental health issues is bringing the parents in as soon as they can, and as soon as it feels right and safe, due to that, mental health professionals will decide that. And that's why they weren't concerned about having that, just that entry point for students to be able to talk to somebody first, because part of therapy is definitely those support networks. So yes, they would be pulled in.
Thank you, Representative Joaquin. Representative Baker, any other questions? Okay, I am not seeing any other hands up for questions. Representative Joaquin, closing comments, please.
I just want to thank the real voices that matter here, and that's Ms. Steen, Ms. Nankundi, and Ms. Jama for being willing to come here and share their stories and share their testimony, and frankly, to bring this bill and put into action. Without our young people really pushing us and letting us know what they're experiencing, sometimes they get totally left out of good public policy, and that's what this is, good public policy, and I would love your support. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Joaquin. There being no further discussion, the chair renews his motion that House File 375, as amended, be recommended for referral to the Human Services Finance and Policy Committee. The clerk will take the roll.
Fisher.
Aye.
Fisher, aye. Frederick.
Aye.
Frederick, aye. Frankie.
Aye.
Frankie, aye. Backer.
Backer, aye.
Backer, aye. Baker.
Baker, aye.
Baker, aye. Hansen.
Aye.
Hansen, aye. Katiza Watoon.
Aye.
Katiza Watoon, aye. Lippert.
Lippert, aye.
Lippert, aye. Mueller.
Aye.
Mueller, aye. Pearson.
Pearson, aye.
Pearson, aye. There being 10 ayes and 0 nays, the motion prevails.
There being 10 ayes and 0 nays, the motion prevails. House File 375, as amended, is recommended for referral to the Human Services, Finance, and Policy Committee. I want to once again thank everyone for today's discussions on all the issues that we have before us. I also want to do a reminder to the public that we will continue to accept written testimony on today's agenda items for the record for the next 24 hours. They will be posted on our site and also shared with the committee. I want to thank everybody for being part of it, and we are adjourned. Thank you.